evening, everyone. Let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Someday. Right. In honor of Moses, someday.
Someday.
All right. May we have the roll call, please?
Good evening, commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Starting with Chair Commissioner Hartwig.
I am present.
Vice Chair Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Castillo, I understand, is excused. And Commissioner Montgomery.
Here.
Commissioner Pitts.
Present.
Commissioner Zhang Li.
Here.
And Commissioner Griggs Murphy.
Here.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve last month's minutes?
I so move.
Second.
Okay, been moved and seconded. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Abstentions? Carried unanimously. Okay, moving on to item four, there is no old or unfinished business. Are there any modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, on to new business, item A.
Good evening, commissioners. And first, I want to welcome our new commissioner, Donna Griggs Murphy, to the board. Thrilled that you're here. And Jenna Castillo was not able to make it tonight, just wanted to extend. I know you ran into her last week. She said she wanted to welcome you as well. So I just want to send you her good wishes as well. In terms of our first item, we have the presentation of acceptance of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or the CAFER, for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2014. And I will turn it over to Tracy Stabler, our Chief Financial Officer, to make a report along with the audit.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm going to present tonight the Comprehensive Financial Annual Report for the year ending June 30, 2014. Before I go into a detailed review of the CAFER itself, I'd like to introduce to you Cynthia Pond with Macias Guinea O'Connell, our independent outside auditors. She has a very quick presentation. She'd like to discuss a couple items with you.
Okay. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Cindy Pond, and I am the engagement partner on the authority's financial statement and federal compliance audit for 2014. The first slide.
Sorry.
Okay. Oh, there it is.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it's getting there. No, it's good now.
Okay.
Page down.
You just return.
Okay. In terms of the first slide, our responsibility and the authorities' responsibilities are described on page one of our audit report of the CAFR. The management's responsible for the preparation and the fair presentation of these financial statements in accordance with accounting principles generally accepted in the United States, or GAAP. Our responsibility is to express opinions on these financial statements based on our audit.
Excuse us.
Okay.
And I think the commissioners have a hard copy in their packet at the back.
So. Okay, great. Okay, great. Duplicate? Okay. Well, hopefully you have a hard copy as well. Technical difficulties. The scope of the engagement includes the business type activities. That's seven. A duplicate?
Yeah.
That's good. Oh, okay, great. Thank you.
There we go.
Oh, okay, that works out. Okay. The scope of our engagement includes the business-type activities of the authority. The 10 discreetly presented component units of the authority are not audited by us, but are separately audited by other auditors of these individual component units. We also, during this year, audited and separately reported on two other of the authority's blended component units or subsidiaries or affiliates, the California Affordable Housing Initiatives and the Oakland Affordable Housing Preservation Initiatives. In terms of the audit results are found on page one of the audit report or the CAFR. In addition to that, we also prepared a report required under government auditing standards. It's the compliance report, which is found on pages 85 and 86. And we also prepared a report on compliance for each of the major federal program or the single audit report, which is found on pages 86 and 87. All of these reports are summarized on page 91, which I will go over in our next slide. We also prepared a separate bound report, the report to the Board of Commissioners, which includes the required communications to the governing body and our other observations. Is slide two? Oh, that is slide. Oh, yeah, that's good. Slide two. A summary of our results are, like I said, found on page 91 of the report. It's broken up into two parts. The financial statement results, we rendered an unmodified or a clean opinion on the financial statements, and we did not have any material weaknesses or other significant internal control findings to the report. Over the past 5 years, the authority has worked diligently in reducing the severity and corrected the significant issues it has in the past related to financial reporting, interfund transactions, and other internal control deficiencies that we noted in past years. They should be commended in setting the tone in proactively working in improving its financial reporting processes and improving its timeliness of its financial reporting. Remember, in our first year, we didn't present the annual report until the following August by the time the following year started. So they've made significant strides over the past 5 years in ratcheting up the timeline. So this is a favorable outcome. Also on page 91, we also had a summary of the federal award results. We also performed a compliance audit on the authority's expenditures of its federal awards. Since the authority had more than 500,000 of federal expenditures during this past year, HUD requires that we perform additional compliance test work on the authority's grant management and control activities. The authority had three major federal programs this past year, the Moving to Work demonstration program, the Housing Choice Voucher cluster of programs, and the Shelter Plus Care. We also issued an unmodified or a clean opinion on compliance and did not have any material weakness findings over compliance to report. We did note a significant deficiency over compliance for the Shelter Plus Care program in the area of eligibility and related special tests and provisions. That finding is listed and summarized on page 92 of the report. The last bound report we had was under professional standards, we are to provide the oversight bodies with the following information: the qualitative aspects of the accounting practices. The authority was required to implement one new accounting standard this past year. This new standard did not impact the authority's financial statement presentation. The other communications listed in the report are nothing out of the ordinary for the authority. In summary, during the audit for 2014, we did not encounter any difficulties or disagreements with management. We also included in the report an observation on a control deficiency on its internal control over the eligibility compliance of its Moving to Work program. But you know, overall, it's the authority, as I mentioned earlier, has made great strides in correcting its deficiencies noted in prior years. In 2015, some of the key changes for the authority include GASB Statement Number 68, and that is the new pension standard. All state and local governments will be wrapping its head around this new requirement, one of which that most state and local governments will be showing a new liability, a net pension liability, on the face of its financial statements that they didn't have in prior years. In prior years, this was just a disclosure item. So that's going to be a significant change. With the authority, unlike a lot of other agencies, they have recorded a net pension asset over the past 2 years, and we'll be looking at that in evaluating what the net number will be once CalPERS provide information to its member agencies. So that's going to be a significant change coming up in 2015. The other change relates to uniform guidance for federal awards. The authority, as a recipient of federal grants, will be looking at new federal compliance requirements to get better conformity with procurement and other OMB requirements that are set forth this upcoming year. The audit requirements for those new changes will take in effect starting in 2016. And with that, I'll let Tracy go into more detail.
Did anyone have any questions for Cynthia?
Yes, you have a question? Okay, go ahead.
In regards to the pension funding, I read through the bigger booklet, and is the Housing Authority, if I'm reading the chart right on page 55, close to full funding of their pension liability? It looks like it's 88.5%. Is that correct?
Page 55, yes, it is. It's 88.5% as of an actual value date of 2013.
Okay. So the Housing Authority is actually doing quite well in comparison to other local governments.
Yeah, if you look at it, usually anything over 80% is you know, on the
board
favorable.
Had authorized 5 years ago a resolution where we were allowed to pre-fund both our pension and our health benefit trust plans in anticipation of trying to pay down this liability before it would hit the book. So I'll present later, there's actually a net asset that we've been paying towards it that will help offset some of the liability.
Good work. Thank you.
Just a couple of questions. First of all, thank you again for a well laid out report. I am looking at page 92, and under condition and content, you did 40 tests. And I wanted to know, in 3 tenant cases, files were missing. How does that happen?
In terms of documentation missing. So during our audit, you know, we take the whole population, in this case about 36,000 items within the population. We haphazardly select 40 items, and we request for documentation to support the various, in this case, eligibility requirements. Okay. And in this situation, 3 of the tenant case files were not did not include the rent reasonableness determination documentation that the other 37 had. So it could be the case of misfiling most likely misfilings.
Okay, well, when I read it, that stuck out to me. That stood out, so thank you for explaining that. Mm-hmm. On page 93, under the audit finding, during our testing, the eligibility requirements for the moving towards Section 8, tenant case is 40 from a population of 894 were examined.
Yeah, for the findings on page 93, yes. Both of these are prior year findings, and what we do is that we retest these programs to see whether or not they're recurring deficiencies, or whether or not the corrective action plan took hold and the finding was not noted in this current year. And in both situations, on page 53, the authority implemented its corrective action plan, and we did not note a similar type of deficiency this year.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that.
Okay, I just had a question on the GASB 68. Mm-hmm. So is that a situation where we have an actual liability that previously was disclosed in notes, and now it is going to actually be part of the balance sheet?
Yes, the computation of it is also changed and redefined as well with the new standards. So it's not going to be exactly what was known as the unfunded actual accrual liability, which was noted on page 55.
They changed the method of calculating it.
Changed the method of calculating, of amortizing. They provided more defined parameters. In the past, for example, you had a menu of seven different types of actual valuation methodologies one could choose from, and they were all acceptable. And now they say, well, now you all got to use this one. So everything should be more comparable.
See.
From one organization to the other is part of the plan.
I see.
The other part of the major change is in the past there was a connection between funding of the pension plan and how the liability is recorded accounting-wise. In the new standard, they decoupled both of those things. The accounting is the accounting, and the funding policy and how an organization decides to fund the plan will be a separate discussion, and it wouldn't be an accounting standard.
So the funding the funding of the plan is separate from the accounting standard.
Yes.
What you used to do in the past was they would calculate the amount you had to pay in this year to meet all your future obligations. So you had an annual required payment. And if you failed to make that, the difference that you failed to make became your liability. Mm-hmm. The new standard is going to call for your liability really is what they're calculating that you're going to have to pay out, less what you have, the assets you have in the plan to pay for.
I see. So the new way is more reflective of the actual liability. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Then.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Because as long as
it's actually a step forward in the world of making this pension stuff a little less obscure and impenetrable.
Right.
Yeah. That is the goal.
Okay.
That is
you
the goal.
Very, much.
Very good. If there are no other questions, I'll continue on with the CAPR itself. First, I just want to give you a little overview of how it's laid out on your page Roman numeral 5 is the table of contents that shows that there's four basic sections: the introductory section, the financial section, the statistical section, and the federal compliance section. And that's laid out more to kind of give a better flow in the areas that you want to look at. So the introductory section obviously is it's got a letter of transmittal, it's got a chart of accounts, it lays out who our governing body is and who our senior management is. One thing I would like to point out is on page Roman numeral 5 is the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. That was what we were so proud last year that we submitted for the first time, and this is the actual award, so we're now able to put it in our CAFR and tell people we've earned it. So I really like that a lot. So in the financial section is the financial statements, the notes the audit report itself from the independent auditors, and management's discussion and analysis, which is an executive summary of the financial statements and the activity for the year. As Cindy had mentioned, on page one is the independent auditor's opinion on the financial statements themselves, which was unmodified this year. The management discussion and analysis starts on page five, and again, it's just an executive overview of the activity for the year. The financial statements start on page 11, and that's the statement of net position, or what most people refer to as the balance sheet. Just a couple of things to point out notable there is there's two columns. One is the primary government, and the second column is the discretely presented component units. The primary government is all of the authorities, public housing, the blended components of CAHI and OPI, and there are general business and general programs, all of our federal programs in one. The discretely presented component units are the combined total of all of our affiliates that meet the criteria to be a discrete component unit, which means that we either control them or we're so financially interrelated that it would be misleading to not include them. So this is going to be most of our mixed finance partnerships that we report here. Okay.
So that would not be OPI, right?
OPI no, OPI is part of the primary government.
Okay,
yes.
Perfect.
Current assets, just to point out, is up about $10 million from last year. A lot of that is our notes receivable going up. Some of our receivables from HUD have gone up, and some of our cash has gone up. The long-term assets is up $18 million, and this is primarily the long-term funding that we do with our affiliates for the projects that are being built, the Lion Creek 5, Alva Vista, and Lakeside Senior. Current liabilities are down approximately $3 million from last year, and that's mainly just a timing difference between when the last day of the fiscal year ends versus when we, you know, get all of our last invoices in. Our net assets went up $38 million, and that's just the derivative of our revenue against our expenses, which is on page 13, called the Statement of Revenue, Expenses, and Changes in Net Assets, commonly referred to as the income statement. Some notable items there is that our revenues were up $13 million from fiscal 13, primarily due to changes in the housing assistance revenues coming in. Our total expenses are up $12 million, and again, that's related to an increase in the housing assistance payments made out to our participants. Capital contributions are up $12 million, and that was the funding mechanism we used to pay to our discrete component units to do the funding for Ave Vista and Lion Creek 5, et cetera. So we drew down on our capital fund program revenue and used that to fund the affordable housing construction. Our notes, I will skip over the cash flow unless anybody has a really strong urge to discuss that. It's just showing how our money was spent and how our money comes in. The notes to the financial statement just take the activities of the financial statements and expand on them in more in-depth detail. I would point out on page 17, note one is the disclosure of the financial reporting entity itself, so it gives you a very in-depth detail of who all of our blended component units are and our discretely presented component units, so you can find out what entities make up each of those columns in the financial statements. On page 23 begins note two, and that's a summary of our significant accounting policies, so it tells you how we will handle the financial transactions throughout any given year on each of the major line items of the financial statements themselves. And then on page 49, I would point out, starting with note 12 and then note 13, starting on page 49, is a description of the, it's a combining schedule, so to speak, that gives you the detail of the discretely presented component unit columns of the financial statement. So it gives you greater detail of their activities.
Very good.
Okay. On page 55, Cynthia had already discussed a little bit with you, is required supplementary information that gives detail of the funding progress of both our miscellaneous pension plan and our OPEB health benefit plan. And then on page 57, are beginning a series of combining schedules, which are the financial statements, the balance sheet and income statement, but it lays it out into how everything gets grouped. There's a combining statement of federal, non-federal, and general programs, and then there's a second combining schedule that tells you all the individual components of both the federal column, the federal program column, and then on the non-federal program columns. And then starting on page 70 is your statistical section. And this has got a lot of valuable information because it gives you up to a 10-year comparison of a lot of the financial statement components. So if you want to see how we do over a period of time, this is a great section to read and to look at. And then starting on page 85 is the federal compliance section. Cynthia had already gone over her reports. There's a report in accordance with government auditing standards on both our internal controls and our compliance with laws, regulations, and other matters. And then the second report is on our federal programs under the single audit. That's followed by page 89 is the schedule of expenditure of federal awards, which shows you exactly what federal awards we expended this year. This schedule is for Oakland Housing Authority only and does not include CAHI's federal activities because they issue their own single audit. If you look on page 90, it will tell you the amount that was CAHI. We do it as a disclosure to that statement. And then finally, on starting on page 91 is a schedule of findings and question costs that Cynthia had already gone over with you. And it just tells you what is current year findings, what is the status of any prior year findings, and then what is the corrective action that the authority is taking to address those findings. So that is, in a nutshell, our CAFR this year. If you had any particular questions.
Well, I would like to commend everyone on a very, very fine job here. In fact, I think that for the edification of new commissioners, we should just bring out a report from about 8 years ago so you can really, I mean, the difference is mind-boggling. I mean, this has been a sustained ascent to something like this, which is really, really excellent. Easy to understand, all the data is there, and it is possible to use this to analyze, make decisions, and do whatever we want. So very, very fine work.
Thank you. I would like to give kudos to my entire department. The finance department put in a lot of hours and a lot of hard work, in addition to a lot of their other duties to make sure this went as smoothly as it could this year. I think both Macias and our department was very pleased with how well the audit went this year.
Most excellent.
I just wanted to second that and say it's definitely a living document to your certificate of achievement and excellence in financial reporting.
Yes.
Definitely lives and breathes that. And I'll move to approve.
Move to approve. We have a second.
No second.
We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. And I want to just commend Tracy Stabler, Janet Rice, and all the Finance Department, and also the operating departments who are really essential in making this all happen. A good audit doesn't come just on the financial side. It actually is everyone working together. And I also want to commend the board for pressuring and for working with staff over the last 7 years that I know of to move us in the right direction and get transparency. I don't think this agency's, one, ever had an audit this clean, and secondly, this transparent. We have more information in the Consolidated Annual Financial Report than we have ever put out there on this agency, so people can really look at it and review it, and we'll put it online, I think, tomorrow.
Yeah. Right, and I can also say that I've met with the auditors every year, and these are very good auditors we have. They're very thorough. I mean, you can just tell by talking to them. So when we're getting a clean report here, you know, we're getting a thorough investigation, and that is really important because, you know, all of us really rely on that. We rely on that external oversight as well as internal excellence to make sure that we know what is going on with this agency. So thank you all.
And a special thanks to Cindy Plum for putting up with us for all these years. I do appreciate it working with us.
Okay, so now we're moving on to item B.
Item B is authorizing the executive director to take any and all actions and execute all documents necessary to close construction financing for the 11th and Jackson Street affordable housing development that OHA is partnering with East Bay Asian Development Corporation, Ibaltzi, to develop, which isn't verbatim for that because I was reading the other agenda item, but it's the same agenda, in conjunction with East Bay Ibaltzi. And this item brings a lot of things we've talked about in private, in closed session, and also in open session regarding our 11th and Jackson. Carlos Castaneros is here from Ibaltzi, and Phil is here, and I don't know if you want to come up and give us a briefing of what we're authorizing. I want to say that I am very proud of Ibaltzi for getting us this far and ready to break ground. I was skeptical that it could be done in this economic environment where affordable housing funding is evaporating before our very eyes, and they have managed to pull it off. And please send my congratulations to Josh on your work on this, and I'll turn it over to Phil.
Good evening, commissioners. Again, I'm Phil Nivel, Deputy Executive Director for Real Estate Development. And Eric's already pointed out the Director of Development from Ibaltzi is in the audience tonight, which is Carlos Castellanos. Our project manager, Clint Loftman, has been felled by the flu tonight, has been told to stay home for 3 days. Must be bad. But very quickly, I wanted to just walk you down memory lane a little bit about the history of this project. As you know, we purchased a site at 11th and Jackson. Ibaltzi actually found the site and got us in touch with the seller. Originally, this property had been, let's say, he'd gotten, the original owner had entitlements for a large condo building at three times the price, and we were able to buy the property and work with the Ibaltzi. The authority's role was that we bought the land. Ibaltzi took the lead on the development work. We provided a pre-development loan for up to half the pre-development expenses. The authority also provided 35 project-based vouchers, awarded those to the project, which is 71 units. The land itself is two-thirds of an acre. Ibaltzi worked diligently with the authority and went out and looked for funds. And most powerfully, they were able to garner an allocation of 9% tax credits, which brings in well over $20 million equity. They also got several million dollars from the city of Oakland, 2.75 to be exact. And they also got special needs funding from Alameda County in the form of the HOPWA funds, Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS, which is $1.2 million. And then finally, they were able to garner the state housing community development funds from the infill infrastructure program, over $3.1 million. So they did a masterful job in putting together all these sources of financing in order to be able to move forward. The 9% tax credit award requires that we have our construction closing by March 23rd, or we lose over $20 million. So we plan on meeting that schedule. Nothing to be trifled with. I would also mention that Ibaltzi's had several different staff people working on this, including Enner Chu, who you've seen here before. Enner's now in charge of figuring out what to do with the retail component, which Ibaltzi will manage. And they brought in other staff persons as was needed on the site. So again, we hope to break ground in March, and begin construction of this project. You know that we've been recently leasing up all the units at Cathedral Gardens in our partnership with EAH. Also, we've been leasing up Lion Creek Crossings Phase 5, the senior project there. We are almost, we're just starting, in fact. Today was a banner day for one of our projects. Our leased housing department has been working very, very hard with developer Saha, Satellite Affordable Housing Associates, and over 40 units were approved today alone. So the Michelle Hassan and Tila Carpenter's team was out there today inspecting all these units, and the families were ready to move in. So those, as we're finishing those projects, and we still have Ave Vista on West Grand under construction, we now have the next one lined up to break ground and go forward in March. So with that, if you have any questions, I'm sure Carlos could step up if you have any for him or for me. Thank you.
I just have one quick question, Phil. It says all funds have been previously awarded, so at this time there would be no funding required, but at other deals previously in the past, we've had gap funding required at the very last minute. Does this authorize Executive Director Johnson to make that decision outside of the board if needed?
No, Commissioner, we don't need any more funds. That's to Baldsey's credit that they were able to develop the project without any further gap financing from the Housing Authority. On the other hand, we did spend more on this land than on the land that we've brought to you for any construction closing in the past, so there was a larger commitment there. We think it's ready to go. Tonight's resolution really is a catch-all resolution developed by Jennifer Bell's partner, Michelle Brewer, for all the smaller level items that need to be signed by our executive director as we go to close. The land lease being one, there's all kinds of little assorted things too numerous to name. We have him sign until he gets a hand cramp, and hopefully that'll happen in the middle of March.
So the funding that we've awarded is both the land value that's written into the deal and the project-based Section 8 voucher award. So
if there was unanticipated gap funding needed,
we would be
with this,
back. Huh? I would come back.
You would come back.
Come back.
Right. Okay. That's the question. Excellent. Make it happen, Captain.
Thank you. Clarifying that. Very good.
Okay. Yes. I just want to make a comment. It's important that with all the need for affordable housing that we're still moving forward, and I want to just give kudos to Abalsi. And just making some more units, there's still never going to be enough, but we are making strides, so I'm proud to be part of that. Just wanted to make that comment.
Yes, so Phil, the commercial space, what's going to go in there?
That's a work in progress.
Okay.
Carlos, would you have any insights other than?
Not at this point. Other than you mentioned.
Okay. Inner Chu has moved over to be the head of Ibaltzi's economic development sort of retail unit. So he's no longer working on the affordable housing side. And he is tasked to help plan and program that retail space.
Okay.
And they have a lot of ideas. I might add that one of the things they're working on right now is naming the project. The address, we've always called it 11th and Jackson because it's on the corner, but the address is 978 11th, or it's somewhere on 11th, 976 11th Street. So that'll be the project address, but we still need a name for the project, so they'll be working on that. We don't have to name it before the closing, but we could.
Thank you, Phil.
Well, in addition to Ibaltzi's good work on this project, I just want to appreciate the good partnership that the Housing Authority has had with Ibaltzi on this and with other affordable housing developers, because the Housing Authority has been so instrumental in making affordable housing projects move forward, especially with the loss of redevelopment agency funds.
Indeed. Thank you.
Moved. We have a second. We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay. All right, so now we are on to item C.
Item C is presentation and discussion of a sponsor-based housing assistance program evaluation that was completed by Apton Associates in our sponsor-based program, which I think we're all very proud of and encouraged by the study. And I'd like to call up some folks to give us a brief presentation. Before we start, I just wanted to say that doing these kind of studies by Apt is something that I feel real strongly about as an MTW agency, that when we have innovations that we think should be shared with the world, the best way to share them is having a real third-party assessment of what's going on. We had committed to the board that we were going to do an evaluation on the first 3 years. The first 3 years, we're now in the fourth, going on more, but we wanted to take the first initial families and really see what happened to them and be able to share that with HUD and other agencies basically throughout the country. We are one of the few agencies in this country that are able to do a sponsor-based, that have the approval in the MTW plan. And I think more than any program that we have in our MTW kind of world, this one can inform, I think, a lot of policy change if we are thoughtful about the way we implement it and if we are good at getting the word out. So I'm going to turn it over to Lenita to give us a presentation of what it is when they get the PowerPoint up, and they'll walk through what the sponsor-based program is, because it serves several different populations. And the outcome of it was originally 110, but it was really, I think, 125 families we initially enrolled, and what happened to them. So as they pull that up, Lenita, I'll turn it over to you. Are you?
Thank you.
You good?
Good evening, Commissioners.
How's your voice?
I'm Lenita Ellis, Director of Family and Community Partnerships. Can you hear me okay? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to review for you what the sponsor-based housing assistance program is, how it fits into our MTW activities, a brief description of the program and the evaluation, and I'll take any questions. So the sponsor-based housing assistance program is designed to expand opportunities for low-income individuals who typically are not eligible for our standard public housing and Section 8 programs. We're able to do this through our MTW activities. It's a local housing assistance program, which was implemented and identified in our fiscal year 2010. We're able to do this through the single fund budget, which allows for full flexibility. And it also is allowed through block grant funding from the public housing, the HCV, and the CFP funds. And it's under our statutory objective of increasing housing choice options. This is what we do in partnership with the City of Oakland. It provides rental housing assistance, which serves individuals who are homeless, living in encampments. Also homeless individuals who are exiting the criminal justice system, including youth who are also coming out of our foster care system. And the individuals must be receiving services from providers that are currently under contract with the City of Oakland. In their current budget, the funding is $1.5 million. The city does not receive any administrative funds from the Oakland Housing Authority. The funding covers their security deposits, their utility payments, any repairs and cleaning to the units, also their housing placement services, which come through Abode and First Place for Youth. This is when they find the landlords for us. They ensure that it's a good placement, a good match for the individuals, making sure that the neighborhood's going to be a good fit for them, things of that nature. It won't be in an area that could trigger any substance abuse or mental health challenges that they may have in their background or their past. The eligibility of the individuals, I went over again about them being homeless in an encampment or coming from the criminal justice or foster care system. Their income must still be below the 50% area median income. They still are prohibited from being convicted for the production or manufacture of methamphetamines or subject to the lifetime registration requirement. They must still meet our standard immigration and eligibility requirements. And again, they must be referred by an approved service provider who's working with the City of Oakland. And the evaluation portion, like all of our MTW initiatives, this project was also required to go through an evaluation so we can go through the best practices and learn from any challenges that we'd experienced. The Housing Authority did commission apt associates. They are experts on homelessness. And the data was collected and analyzed for an initial 125 clients who entered the sponsored-based housing assistance program from June 1st, 2010 through June 30th, 2012. The initial contract was for 110 individuals. With any new pilot project that is new, there was some initial turnover. Initially, there were 10 youth who were in the contract. We ended up serving 19. There were initially, I believe, 40 individuals, adults from encampments and reentry we were desiring to serve. We ended up serving 44. So that's why that 110 ended up being 125. These next few slides are going to go over some snapshots of enrollment and some other aspects of the evaluation. I believe you've received these in the bound evaluation copies. This is some information on enrollment. The first year, the average enrollment time it took was 37 days for individuals from the time they were identified as eligible through the time they were actually placed in a stable housing unit. The second year was 50 days. The increase in length of lease-up time was due to housing quality standards. Some of the landlords took longer in the second year in addressing some of the HQS items that were identified. And there also were some delays in the criminal background screening with getting individuals through that process in the second year. Some evaluation snapshots on this slide with respect to the outcomes. 48 of the first 125 clients have left the program. 60% or 29 of those exited with which was deemed stable and permanent reasons, meaning they were living on their own or they were with a friend or a family member. And for those who left that was not a stable reason, 77 of those are still in the sponsored-based housing assistance program. I'd like to remind you that this is a three-year pilot program, so we're still within that time frame, which is why 77 of them are still in the program. And of those who left, the most unstable reason, or the most common unstable reason, which counts for 15% of them, they had returned to incarceration or to homelessness, which represents 12% of them. Some outcomes I'll highlight for you. I won't go through all of them, but some of the things that did work. The vulnerable populations that the Housing Authority sought to house were identified at risk for homelessness, were housed and placed. And so that's what worked. We actually identified those who we were seeking to identify and place in housing. Clients who are in the sponsored-based housing assistance program have access to a range of resources to address their housing barriers, from mental health to substance abuse and employment. While they are in this program, they have a diverse range of case management services available to them, and that is working very well. And nearly all of the clients had some increase in income during their stay. Some items that were identified that weren't working very well for us as very few of the clients graduated the program with a sufficient amount of increase in income in which to live independently. And we all know that we do live in a very expensive area. While many of them were able to exit the program, they did still have to move in with someone else or another subsidized housing program, but they weren't able to live completely on their own. And the other item that was identified is very few options exist for clients who could be transitioned out, but again, unable to afford completely unsubsidized housing. So those are just a couple of things that I pulled out for you from this table. And some of the recommendations. The evaluators recommended that the Housing Authority maintain the current model of contracting with the City of Oakland. And this slide is, this recommendation is essentially, I've paraphrased that there for you. Another recommendation is that they've asked, essentially, the sponsored-based housing assistance program is a housing-first model, which states that if you place an individual in stable housing, once they're in stable housing, it will then allow for them to address other areas of their life, which will stabilize them from that place of having secure housing, from that platform of having secure housing. These two recommendations, number two and number three, are suggesting to the Housing Authority that while we have different populations in our sponsored-based housing assistance program, that we adjust our outcomes and metrics by taking that into consideration and not have such a broad stroke of our outcomes and apply some nuances to those who are in encampment versus those who are in reentry, so on and so forth. So they're suggesting that we adjust the logic model and the metrics to take those nuances into account for the different populations who are in the program. Again, this fourth and fifth recommendation are also, again, asking that we further define our goals and our metrics for these populations. The fourth one is suggesting that we actually address housing stability specifically as an outcome for our specific populations, as well as recommending that we participate in the County of Alameda's homeless intake system, that we participate in that network of providers who are addressing homelessness separate from the provider meetings that we have with the City of Oakland and the providers who are in our sponsored-based housing assistance program. And then also, we have some individuals who, due to their mental health challenges and other challenges, who, for various reasons, are unable to participate in the case management process. The providers are recommending that they set aside some slots in what's called the assertive community treatment team model, which has a smaller a caseload focus, if you would, for these individuals, which perhaps would allow these individuals to be drawn in to the sponsored-based housing assistance program. These individuals right now are currently being screened out because they're not coming forward and participating in our intake process. And the evaluators are stating perhaps if there are some slots set aside in this ACT team, that these individuals may be able to have perhaps a transitional process with beginning to get case management services, and that's what recommendation number six is stating. Recommendation number seven is suggesting that there be further screening process for the youth. And then finally, recommendation number eight is suggesting that there be a requirement of every single provider to track how long it takes for the lease-up process. Some providers are doing it, others are not, and the evaluators are recommending that we require that everybody does it. There are additional recommendations in the evaluation. I only pulled out a handful for you here, and this has been a very brief overview of our sponsored-based housing assistance program and the evaluation. I'd be more than happy to entertain any questions that you have.
I'd also like to take the opportunity to acknowledge, we have Susan Shelton here, who is the program manager for the OPRI program, and she too is here to answer any questions that you might have. We also have Dan Simmons. He is also here and can, he's one of the providers and can answer any questions. Thank you.
Oh, well, as you guys know, this is one of my favorite programs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. And I'm really pleased to hear we are continuing to make a difference in the city of Oakland in serving hard populations like these. So I don't, maybe I can ask either Dan or Susan these questions. One of my questions is, Susan, what is the process when they're exiting the criminal justice system? Because I know with so many are exiting. So, and maybe you can answer this, Dan. What is the process when they're exiting the criminal justice system? Who are we working with? Is there a post-integration process?
You mean the participants in the program?
Yes, where, in the program.
Where are they coming from? So we'll talk about project.
Okay, they're coming
and
from.
And if you can state your name for the record.
My name is Dan Simmons, and I work for the city of Oakland, actually. I'm one of Susan's colleagues, and one of my duties is I'm the program officer or the program monitor for our reentry programs under what was Measure Y. Was going forward, what would be Measure Z. And in the past 10 years, we've had a program called a case management, intensive case management program called Project Choice. And they work in San Quentin, working with guys pre-release, getting them ready, creating relationships with them, doing assessments, building the plans with them, working out in the community with their families, with family reunification, and doing some cognitive things with them. They do a change curriculum with them inside. And then they come outside and work with these same individuals. So all of our guys in the housing program, they all came through San Quentin and Project Choice. So and gotten all of the hands-on case management and other things that address their needs in that process.
Okay, so Dan, we don't do anything with Santa Rita.
I'm sorry, I can't.
Santa Rita? Do we do anything with Santa Rita?
No, we don't. We did in the past with we had leveraged some of our Measure Y dollars and got a second chance grant, in which we worked with the probation and the sheriff's department, and we did a version of Project Choice inside Santa Rita. And after the second chance grant ran out, I think what they are doing, they're actually doing a version of Project Choice, I believe, inside Santa Rita now, that was built on the model that we ramped up with Second Chance Act.
Okay. And then my last question, 15% that went back in, the 15% that went back into prison, I mean, what happened?
Well, I don't know if that was our total, if it was a total.
That's very interesting. So we've been studying this evaluation too, and we're going to certainly take this back and review our records relative to this as well. What I can say, whether I agree with the percentage or not, it was just not reentry people going back in. It was some of our encampment folks who didn't come out of reentry. Again, criminal behavior. It was some of the youth as well. But I just wanted to say it just wasn't the reentries that were returning. We, in fact, saw, in comparison to the state recidivism level, those folks in OPRI who operate through this housing and these services, their recidivism rate was considerably less than it is around the state, which begins to indicate for us, as we said to you before, what a difference housing makes in stabilizing folks and keeping them from going back in.
Can I say something
real
quick? I've been with Oakland United and Measure Y for quite a while. And prior to this program coming online for us, this is probably the biggest gap in our reentry component. We've struggled with years trying to get a housing component with our reentry, and we came close several times. We identified sites to house people, but there was always something to prevent us from doing it, whether that be, you know, not in my neighborhood or neighborhoods just saturated with other things that just didn't want to be a part of this. So when this opportunity came along, it filled a tremendous void in what the work that we're doing. And it's had a tremendous impact on the individuals that we're serving. So when we talk about them going back, our particular population is not, as when you look at the recidivism rate and you look at the people who went back and through this program, there's no comparison. And there's no serious offenses that the guys went back to prison for. So I think this program for speaking for reentry, it filled a big void, and it's had a tremendous positive impact on what we're doing, keeping guys stabilized, and so we can move them forward. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you, Lenita. Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, looking at the numbers, how did you reach the 125? Population. I see it's broken down into 10 youth, and so how did you, was it funding or was it just those that applied or?
Ms. Montgomery, my name is, I don't know if I've introduced myself yet or not, and I'm Susan Shelton, and I manage the Community Housing Services Division. My population is homeless. So that's what you can expect me to be expert in communicating with you. I have been trained in the last 3 years of this program about reentry and foster youth and youth who are in the criminal justice system. So one of the things that I'm also trained in is how you run a housing program. We work with the housing authority with a specific amount of money, and the housing market does what it does. So sometimes if you've given me money for 20, depending on how I can have those relationships and arrangements, depending on if we get a very sympathetic landlord, depending on if we are master leasing, we may be able to stretch those it's a juggling act each and every day. Unfortunately, over the last couple of years, we've had a number of deaths, and folks who we've gotten off the street and they stabilized, and yet it felt like it was too late in the final analysis. So we've had a couple of people that have fallen out of the program, one going back to permanent housing, may have gone back to jail, some kind of serious illness, or we found other permanent supportive housing support for them. And you then notice that 110, we did 115. There was a year that we may have had 120. So we've been able, with the way that the market is moving, to hold these 125s. And we're doing some things programmatically different as well that has allowed us to do this number. And our arrangement with the Housing Authority is stay within your 1.5. Make sure that you're matching it with service dollars. And we're always looking to see then how many people does that really serve. And it changes from, it can change from quarter to quarter. That's how I want to describe it.
On page 7, I was reading a quote from First Place for Youth, and they're talking about the housing situation of how long, say for 2 years, and after that they have to seek a permanent housing situation. So how does that work? It's in the middle of the page.
Yes, ma'am, I'm reading it.
Yeah.
I hope I'm reading it. You're under the last bullet point of First Place for you?
Yeah, it's in the middle when it says that First Place expects its clients to transition after 2 years from the housing divided by sponsor-based housing to another housing situation that is stable.
Where are we?
She's in a different page.
In the middle of the...
I think the numbers are different. She's really from the bound one. I think the page number's cut off.
Let me just locate it. 1 second.
Okay. So in other words, my question is that once they leave the sponsor-based housing, that they transition to, they have to become independent, is my question.
I can respond to that without reading it.
Okay.
That's correct, Commissioner Montgomery.
Commissioner Montgomery, thank you, Janet. Appreciate it. And I think the evaluators talk about it appropriately in terms of the metric for the different populations. So the population of foster youth and youth who are in the criminal justice system that First Place works with is different from the population I work with, folks who are coming from encampments, much more long-term, chronic, homeless, multiple disabilities, may need support for a very long time. What I've now been taught in these last 3 years is that is not our expectation with our youth. Our expectation with our youth is if they've had issues in foster care, if they've stumbled on their way with the justice system, they are still youth, and we expect that we will be able to hold them, to train them and support them into maturity. But like our own children, we expect them to go off and be able to survive in a society that we call America. So that's our intent with this. They have a 2-year limit in all of their programming, in the housing support that they do. And that's the work and the case management that gets done with them with an intention of decreasing the subsidy, giving you more autonomy till you're on your own. That's the intention. Certainly some people fall outside of that, and we're going to support that. But that's how we approach them. That's our service model.
Well, like Commissioner Hurd, I'm very happy to read about this program happening. There's such a need for it. Yeah. And I think the evaluation is quite well done, and I agree with the recommendations. I do have some questions. I'm also really happy to see the city and the Housing Authority working together on this, along with the service providers. It talked about the need for permanent housing subsidy, and I'm wondering what will happen to these folks once the period is over. And I'd like to get a little more information about where they're being housed. Are they in SROs or apartments or in group homes, or is it all of the above?
Want me to go first? So don't know so much about group homes, but really our work has been about developing relationships with landlords, both in affordable housing facilities as well as market rate. And what we have developed over the years are folks who are very committed citizens and property owners who are saying, yeah, I'm aligned with this kind of thing you're doing to eliminate homelessness and poverty. So we are meeting a whole number of landlords just out in the private market. So we've become much mature since we started this program about what it takes as city government, as nonprofit providers, to create this housing stock. And we are balancing it all the time. So we're all around the city in every kind of housing, including single family apartments, shared housing. We use the array of what is available to us.
And in response to the other part of your question, the sponsor-based housing assistance program is not designed to be permanent housing. It's designed to prepare and get these individuals ready for housing for them that can be permanent. So this is designed to help them address their income, to increase their income. It's designed to help them support whatever issues that are barriers for them for the other more types of traditional housing. So while they're in the sponsored-based housing assistance program, they should be working with the employment counselors, with the case managers, with the mental health providers to prepare and get them ready to be able to apply for other housing programs so they can transition into those.
I do understand that, but reading the report, they did note that many of the former homeless were older, and that it may be more difficult for them to get jobs and increase their income. So, I think the challenge is what happens when the period ends, and where do they go?
That's
Yeah, I think that's, you hit a big piece of the work that we want to do in terms of, you know, that you've established just this month a committee for supportive housing and special needs population. And one of the things that we want to look at, we can use this as report as kind of a launching pad, is how can this program be expanded toward different populations? Or, and even when Michelle was talking about the differences in the money, the 1.5 million different populations take different amount of resources to serve, and managing toward a bottom line figure, they've done a good job with that. But that's, I think we want to dig a little deeper in terms of how many people can we serve with the funding that we have and the different populations. And the thing that this program is, in my view, missing is the exit strategy at the end of stabilization. Mm-hmm. And so we've had some conversations about that. As you know, our senior property at Second Avenue Lakeside Senior is 50% designated toward seniors who were formerly homeless in a homeless program so that they can transition in. That's a solution. But in terms of our broader program, and you consider the largest program is our Housing Choice Voucher program, the question is how can we use that and talk about having a final soft landing for the people who go through this program so that we can take them, stabilize them, and not have them end up back in the circular, which is exactly what we're trying to stop.
Yes.
And these are not the easiest to serve homeless populations that walk into voluntarily to services. So with that in mind, it's so much cheaper for us to provide a housing assistance for a year than it is to try and have them not be housed. It just costs the world less. And I think we're gonna look at that in the ad hoc committee really closely, look at the populations we serve. And I think one of the advantages that we want to do is take advantage of the board's knowledge in these areas beyond what our staff has, and working with some folks who we're going to get together and start mapping out where the needs are, where the funding is for services, and where we can intervene and partner with the housing side.
Excellent. I agree with all the other commissioners on both the value of this program and the excellence of the report. My question is mainly, there's some great recommendations in here. What sort of action plan and timeline do we have in place for actually following up on the recommendations and evaluating if they fit for our program and implementing them? And what can we expect to see as commissioners on follow-up on that front?
Well, part of it is the ad hoc committee, because I'm not certain that I agree with all of the recommendations. I don't know how some of the I think that they're interesting recommendations. I think they're valid, but keep in mind the people who did this came from Seattle and other places.
Yeah.
And I think we have a more informed group, and what you do is you look at them, and that's what I think we want to walk through. In terms of implementing the changes, it would have to occur prospectively, and it would have to occur as part of the agreement and go in over time. There are some things that the partners might be more than willing to do now, and they aren't really an issue for anyone, but I want to look at some of these recommendations, because I don't know that I agree with all of them. There are several that I have issues with. So I don't want to give it a blanket approval in any way whatsoever. I think it's an informed third-party look at our program that can help us through the committee and through Lydia and through Sue Chell and the providers maybe improve our program. And that's what we want to look at it as, not necessarily like here's 1 through 5 like an audit report, let's go fix it. These are recommendations that someone outside thinks might work better, and I think we need to vet that.
Okay.
Do you have another question?
Is the next step then the special needs committee that is being proposed?
Yes.
Okay. And we can expect a follow-up report from them on it?
This.
Yeah, definitely, and probably monthly reports. I'm excited about that committee, and I'm really grateful for the board for putting it together.
Right. So, Marlene, you have another question?
Oh, yeah, just one more question. One of my concerns is people living in encampments, and do they come out of the encampment? How does that work? People that are living in encampments, a lot of them have mental illness, and when they come to you, Dan and Susan, what condition are they in when they come out of that encampment? And what has been the success rate with them coming out of that encampment?
Commissioner Hurd, that is something I can speak more informedly about. We have an outreach program, and as over the 15, 17 years that we've been operating that, we did primarily harm reduction with those in encampments. And, you know, encampments are pervasive in Oakland, which is why we came to the Housing Authority with this proposal about that population. They were really difficult to bring inside, didn't want shelter, no matter if they were so sick, and many of them are, did not want the structure of our programming. And so our outreach team know them rather intimately, where they'll accept ponchos and socks and a ride to the health clinic. They're less likely to take the referral to the shelter. We noticed then that when we had a housing subsidy for their own property, that they were much more willing, and we found that across the board, to listen and engage and begin to develop the trust that it needed. They need to live in housing. It is not an easy journey. And I hope that Lenita will share the stories. We keep collecting their stories, and we've come here to you about them before. But of that 77% that have remained stable for 3 years, most of those are folks from encampments. So we know it can work. I look forward and hope we are invited to this committee that's looking at that, because OPRI has now 3 or 4 years of experience in terms of ramp up and how do you do this and what does it look like and what are the pitfalls and what are the expectations of the different target populations to figure out what's best moving forward.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Susan.
Thank absolutely.
You. Well, I have one question. I'm always interested with these kinds of things, in particular where we're helping groups with special needs. Just a question, I'm always interested in what the scale of the problem really is, and how much of the problem are we even starting to address now? And so what really needs to happen to really make a huge difference here? Because I'm understanding that, I mean, if I'm hearing correctly, there's some subsection of the populations that we're talking about here that are very difficult to get to, because they're just saying, like, I don't want that. But there are a lot that we can get to, and maybe we can even get to those as well. But just, I mean, can you give me an idea of what these populations really look like in Oakland? Because we're talking about homeless, and we're talking about people that have been incarcerated, right, and are coming back into the city. So what are we really looking at in terms of actual numbers of these people in Oakland, and how many are we really helping now? I just want to get a sense of the journey that we're trying to.
I can only speak for reentry, because that's what I do.
Perfect.
But for our population, we are nowhere close to where we need to be as far as resources and to really address the issue of reentry. Our dollars around our Oakland United dollars are primarily employment dollars and a little money set aside for case management. There's no dollars for substance abuse, for mental health. You know, we have to rely on relationships and partnerships and very little money to have our participants access some of these necessities that they need to move forward. So it's really a challenge. When I talked about that big gap in housing, you know, those other two things I just mentioned are also big gaps, and we're on both of those. And when on the unemployment front, we're just nowhere near scale. That we don't have the resources that we need to. We're building opportunities. Like for instance, we've leveraged Oakland Unite dollars, where we have a contract with the state of California, CDCR, and Caltrans, where we have a $5 million contract over 2 years, where we're having guys do go through a transitional subsidized employment program with job development as a part of that. And that's basically, you know, from our leveraging ability. But as far as us being able to identify and to target funding for this significant needs around housing and mental health and substance abuse, we're nowhere near where we need to be as far as in reentry.
Do you have a sense about how many people are coming in? So we're doing this early release. Folks are coming in. His question was more about what's the scale of the number of people, reentry folks, we're looking at in Oakland? What's even an estimate of what that looks
like? Okay, I can't tell you the numbers. I can tell you the populations, though. We got AB 109 populations. We got AB 109 is the realignment population. Which
but I mean, would you say it's like a 5,000 or 10,000 or what? I mean, can we get? I'm just curious.
I can't. Okay. I wouldn't want to hazard a guess there.
Okay,
so.
Fair enough. Yeah.
But we do have those numbers, so we might not have them here because this is this person is a 55-year-old brain.
You can pass them on to me. I can share them with you.
We absolutely will, and yeah. I actually want to point to one of the recommendations said this coordination of other housing and special needs targeting programs that OPRI should work with. We completely align with that. That this work that we do, the Housing Authority is a vital member of it, but it is inclusive of other affordable housing folks that we go to, like the City of Oakland, like the County of Alameda Housing. We've got to figure out housing from all its fronts to figure out how we begin to address the problems. I'm estimating 600 to 1,300 folks who are living on the street currently in Oakland.
600 to 1,300?
1,300. Uh-huh. I think 600 is conservative, and it's interesting that you're asking because our homeless count is this week.
Cool.
And Oakland is doing an Oakland-specific count. So very soon we'll have some numbers where we really know the magnitude of what it is that we're up against, because you always have to figure out who's the most vulnerable in order to target your resources. And that's what we do with OPRI. At least we do that with encampments. So we look forward to continuing to work with the Housing Authority to figure out our most strategic use of these very valuable dollars that are we don't have anywhere else in our city but coming through the Housing Authority this way.
Well, I thank you very much, and also thank you for the work that you're doing for our wonderful community here.
Indeed, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we are on to item D.
Item D is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to amend the contract with Yardi for implementation of services, maintenance, and an integrative property management Section 8 housing and financial management software system, increasing the amount by $750,000 for a new total amount not to exceed of $1,725,570. This item is a follow-up to a resolution you passed actually on August 26, 2013, which authorized a two-year contract with Yardi. The first year contract amount was $970,000 and some change. We have now got to the point where we're ready to go live. We're into the second year, and we're coming back, as we said, for more authorization for the second year. And that will conclude my report, and I'll turn it over to Janet Rice and Craig McBurney to give a report.
Okay.
and answer questions.
Good evening, Commissioners. Janet Rice, Deputy Executive Director, and Craig McBurney, our Director of Information Technology. So we're here to answer any questions. I will defer to Craig to give an update on where we are on the Yardi implementation.
Well, this week, we started the actual conversion process to go live with Yardi. We've been working on this for several months and doing some sample conversions, and there's a lot of process to it. So this week, actually started last Saturday, we started creating the conversion files that we turn over to Yardi on Wednesday, and in the beginning of next week, we get them back, and then we have to do some more converting and start validating them for a go-live on the 9th. So we're in the thick of it.
So this, I would just want to remind the commissioners that this is a conversion of all of our business systems, both financial and program. And the staff have really, although it's coming together in this past week, we've spent the last almost 24 months planning and training and just really looking at our processes to make sure that we can become more efficient and that this system will meet our needs. We have budgeted, the commissioners approved in the budget the monies that we're asking you now to apply to the contract. We suspect that next year the cost will significantly be reduced just because we'll be out of the implementation stages, and then it will be just an annual maintenance fee that will be charged. This year, we will finish up the implementation schedule. There's what we're calling a phase two section in which we will be implementing a resident and a landlord portal, which will make things a lot easier, reduce a lot of paper, and give a lot more access to individuals to see where they are, both on their rent, on the rent side, but then also on the payment side in terms of housing assistance payments, et cetera. So we're very excited about that. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Okay, so this is the information system, a continuation of what we've been doing for like a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That is, but you know, we're doing so well already.
We're going to do even better. It's going to be much easier to get information, to synthesize information, both for our staff, but also for our customers. And our landlords and our residents will really love this. We have experienced some other housing authorities who have landlord portals, and it's amazing. It just allows you to access your information without having to always call in and talk with staff. It's real time. It's right there, so you see when things are posted. That'll make all the difference in the world in terms of our customer service efforts on both fronts.
And I also just want to say that the IT department has done a wonderful job at workarounds over the past many years of patching together a system that doesn't really want to be patched together. And this is an integrated system, and I think that across the board at the Housing Authority, we're excited at getting something as integrated as, and that we know is probably the most used housing management software, not really just for housing authorities, but I mean across the board in the country.
Yeah, you had a question?
Just a statement. I wanted to thank the IT department. I know that a lot of work goes in behind the scenes on stuff like this, so thank you for all your hard work, and I'll move the item. Let's keep the ball rolling.
Item has been moved. We have a second, almost a tie there on seconds. I think Marlene might have edged out Commissioner Lee, but I'm not sure. Okay, but it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? None. Carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'm just curious, is this going to reduce the 9,000 a month phone calls that are coming in?
We hope.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at that number and I was like, that's a lot of phone calls.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. So now we have item E. Recognition of people wishing to address the commission. I have one speaker card here. Looks like it is Ann McClain.
And for the record, Ann McClain, on the copy of her speaker card, has actually requested 15 minutes as opposed to the 3 minutes usually allowed by the board, and you do have a written letter on your that she's provided us. Also, at the end of the letter, she does state that she's got two open appeals with the Section 8 department, correct?
Two open what?
You say you have two open appeals?
Yeah.
Okay. That will be addressed by the Section 8. But if you can come up, you...
Is that permissible to do 15 minutes?
If you want to, I only briefly looked at what she said. I think it's, you know, it actually details program operations that you all are not necessarily familiar with. You probably end up referring it to the executive director. But if you want to give her more time, you're within your rights to do so.
Yeah, because we are, I mean, we are advocates for you, essentially, but we are not operational problem solvers. So in other words, we are going to end up referring you to a specific person who's going to be able to assist you, because this board cannot make operational decisions. Why don't we go for 5 minutes, we'll see where that leaves us, okay? And then we'll make a decision from there for more time. Okay, so we'll start out with 5 minutes.
Okay, well, that leaves a problem. I was told it would be 3 minutes. So then I thought, well, okay, what am I going to say in 3 minutes? I'm basically going to have to abandon this because it is 15 minutes long. So I will speak, but I do want to speak to what you just said, is that you're going to hand it over to probably the person with whom I've been having problems. And who do you go to who might be over that person? You know, that's why I'm here. It's like, you know, the problem is with the leadership in Section 8. The problem is with with Section 8. So what do I do, you know?
Well, let me just say that when problems are brought to us, there are many things that we can do. I'm just saying that the one thing we can't do is make operational departmental decisions. Now, if you bring an issue to us that looks to us like it is a Section 8 and an agency-wide issue, perhaps, there are some other things we can do in terms of reviews and stuff like that on the process. But in terms of, I mean, just to be honest, in resolving specific problems, we've had some people come in here and talk for hours and with all kinds of detail on things that we just cannot make a decision on because we're not authorized to do that. But there are many things we can do. So what we would like to do is have you describe what the problem is, and then if we feel that we have a good enough understanding of the problem, then we will refer it, but then we are going to follow up. We don't just throw it over the transom. I mean, so we will follow up.
All right. What I would appreciate is the courtesy of your reading. I have a 5-page letter there, and with supporting documents. And so my request is that you all read the 5-page letter that I'm not able to read here today, and that I will just talk about what's in that letter.
Yes,
but there's
perfect.
A lot of information in the letter that I can't talk about in 5 minutes.
Okay, understood.
All right.
Understood.
Okay. Yes. My name's Ann McLean. Good evening, commissioners. Thank you for hearing me out. I do have two issues that are on appeal, and basically they've both been dropped, and I'm very dissatisfied about that, and I want something done about it. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to compare you with the rent board, with the Oakland Rental Housing Authority. What is it? No, the rent board, the RAP program, rent. Help me out.
There is an Oakland Rent Board.
Okay, yeah, it's an Oakland Rent Board. And so what I'd like to do is just compare you. I took one tenant out of that program and put that tenant, a tenant requested to be put in Section 8. And I'd heard a lot of bad things about it, but I decided, okay, I'm going to give it a go. So I'd like to say that what I like, even though I don't like the rent board, you know, what landlord wants to be controlled in your rent increases, et cetera. But there are some very good things about it, and I've decided that those things are very good because I'm comparing it with Section 8, which I think just is a terrible program in terms of administration. Okay, rent board. You go in there, and the first thing they give you is called a general packet. The general packet has the ordinance in it, has the regulations, it has eviction control, it has all the information. If you have any questions, you can go up to the sixth floor and talk to people who are there on a daily basis. They'll answer your questions, they'll, you know, give you suggestions about appeals or whatever, and help you organize things. You know exactly what kind of a rent increase you're going to be getting. You know that if you're not satisfied, you can appeal. You're given forms that you can fill out. You go to hearings. Everything's very structured. You know, you're not wondering, well, you know, what do I do? How do I do it? Or whatever. That's not how this program is run in my experience. I'll take a very simple example. I filed for a late fee. By the way, the only thing I've gotten from Section 8 is a contract, a very small little contract. And in that contract it says, I don't trust Section 8 because everything that's been put to me, it's like it doesn't, you know, it just doesn't turn out to be what it is supposed to be. The contract says that I can file for a late fee, but Section 8 can say, well, no, we had a legitimate reason for being late. But they have to, according to my contract, they have to tell me that they had a legitimate reason. So I filed a late fee, and I get a letter back and says, well, why do you need my $25 late fee? You know, and what reason do you have? What can you tell us as to why you're entitled to it? I wrote back and I said, that's not in my contract. You have the burden to tell me why you were late. So, you know, and just to be courteous, I wrote how I'm entitled to this $25. Never heard from them again. When I didn't get a rent increase, I wrote a letter to Mr. Johnson, and I said, if there is an appeal form, I would like to please send it to me. I never got an appeal form at all. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, compared to the other rent board, it's a world of difference, and it leaves a lot to be desired. So I did not get a rent increase last year that I applied for. Had I been in the rent, had I stayed with Oakland Rent Control, I would have gotten a $33 rent increase, because I had a capital improvement, and they allow for capital improvement rent increases. So I would have gotten $33 increase plus a 2.1% banking for the following year it was deferred banking that I could carry over. I got nothing, zero, from Section 8. And so I said, you know, what's going on? And let me see the comps you used. So first of all, Section 8 uses Go Section 8. What is Go Section 8? Go Section 8 is a website that has listings. Is that my?
That's fine. Let me just make an observation here, mm-hmm. I can see that we are moving into an area of technicality that this board is not able to deal with. However, the message that I am getting, what I am hearing from you, and please let me know if I'm interpreting this wrong, that what the real issue here is a communication problem. That you are not getting responses to the questions that you are asking. You are not getting communications f- from the Housing Authority that you feel that are as clear as you are getting from the rent board when you have gone to them. And right now, you don't understand why you were denied a rent increase. You don't understand why you weren't allowed to charge a late fee. I'm not really clear on what was late there, but these are the questions that you have that you did not get answers to. Am I right?
I was totally ignored.
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, you can't deal with, you know, I highly resent dealing with an organization that does not respond or responds, you know, totally incorrectly and, you know, against the contract. You know, if you'll just read my papers, I'll be very happy about that, and you'll understand why I'm making my appeals, why I'm here, because, you know, if, you know, I need to have explanations, something, there's nothing in writing. That's the whole thing. Nothing in writing. I don't have any paper trail, no documentation, only me going to you. Nothing from you back to me.
Okay.
That, that so, is something that we can do something about.
Okay, perfect.
The other thing that I'm using my memory from last summer when you'd written me and intervened, is that there's a nexus between your rent-controlled units and their rents that and the Section 8 program that you had issues with. If I remember.
What does the word nexus mean?
Meaning that you had certain rent-controlled units that had a certain rent and that you felt it was impacting the amount of rent that Section 8 was offering you in terms of your rent increase. That's an interesting thing to look at, is how the local ordinance applies to the Section 8 program, and I think that's worth looking at from the board's perspective as well.
So is there a board that you're associated with that is not part of this? Or
no, what I'm talking about is I will get something in writing to the board and you related to your two appeals and where you are. But I do know that staff has been very diligent about trying to communicate with you, and you filed appeals, I think, to your rent certification last summer. I'm not sure the outcome.
Yes, it's been 8-9 months and I have nothing.
So I will look into that and see where it is and make sure we get you something in response. In addition to that, I think for the boards, what I believe in this case is clarity, probably from legal counsel, is how the rent control ordinance intersects with the Section 8 certificate on a unit in establishing rent levels at a property. And I think that was what, when I looked at your case last summer when I sent it over, was really the issue that we grappled with. And I think that's really a citywide issue that we should maybe look into more closely and get the board a report on.
Well, yes, I think that as a board, what we are requesting is that we see some communication that responds to this so that we now understand your position. We have this here. Now we're going to understand what the response is to that, see what the issues are, and then if there's still something outstanding from there, then we will figure out how we want to proceed in being able to deal with that. Because right now, I'm seeing this as, I mean, what you're saying is you've been ignored, you haven't gotten the communication that you expected to get, and so what we are saying is, let's make sure that communication really does indeed happen to the best of our ability. And then once that transpires, then we're gonna see where that leaves us. Because if we go down into all the technical detail, we will not understand that, because we don't work day to day in this. We are responsible for policy, but good communication with landlords, with residents, with the community does come under that, okay? So that is something that we can make a request for. We have, Eric has agreed to it. So,
Well, like I say, I came here because, you know, there are certain people who head up certain departments and all that, and if you're getting nowhere with it, you've got to go somewhere else.
No, and we appreciate that, because that's why we're here. We want to hear this sort of thing, because now we want to see how it's resolved. We are interested.
Thank you.
So you have our attention, okay? And I want to thank you for coming in and giving us that information. I think all the board will thank you as well.
And I thank you for your time this evening and your contribution to the Oakland housing.
Indeed, thank you. And something will happen here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, now,
here are the written communications.
Yes, written communications.
Written communications. The two monthly reports from both November and December are included in your packet, and those are the standard monthly reports that you receive. Only there's two because of them. The timing of our meetings at the end of the year, we end up catching up in January. And staff's here. We can answer any questions about the reports now, or feel free to always give me a call. The other thing is we have the commission meeting scheduled for 2015. If you want to take a look at that and make sure it's on your calendars, there are a couple of meetings that we historically cancel and change. The first one is over Memorial Day, because we don't have meetings on Memorial Day, so we usually do it the week before. The next one is the week of Thanksgiving. We don't have, and we have one meeting in early December, and then cancel December's meeting. And those are the only meetings we currently have scheduled, although we'll probably have some special retreats during the year. And that concludes my report.
Wow.
For written materials.
Most excellent.
Moving on to executive director's comments, if nobody has any questions.
Mm-hmm.
A couple. I want to let everyone know, and I'm very proud of this, that EPO will be honoring the OHA Palo Vista Gardens Resident Advisory Council as one of the four affordable housing advocacy champions at their 2015 Affordable Housing Week kickoff on May 8th. I hope we have board members able to attend. Very proud of that group. I'm very fond of that group. And I was very surprised when I got the email from EPO that they were lifting them up in such a wonderful way. So I hope that it wasn't confidential, but I wanted to let you know. The Alameda County Housing Authority has informed us that they're going to absorb 200 of our families that are ported into Alameda County. What that means is they're going to start paying the HAP on them, and 20 families per month thereafter until they tell us otherwise. So that means they're going to absorb those families, and we can lease up families in Oakland. So Michelle will be pulling more families off our wait list. I wish Commissioner Castillo was here to hear that, but I will let her know. There are currently 760 families ported out into Alameda County that the City of Oakland is paying for. This is a correction I'm thrilled about, and it allows us to serve Oakland folks and in the appropriate jurisdiction. I just want to let everyone know I have traveled to D.C. I went in December, as you know, and missed the board meeting, unfortunately, and I went again in early January. Those are both negotiating with HUD for the extension of the MTW agreements. It's become very political, like it always is, but particularly related to holding up of an appointment of the Assistant Secretary of Public and Indian Housing. Senator Grassley has written a letter blocking it. One senator can block a nomination, and he did so for a couple of reasons, but primarily over a concern over the extension of our agreements to 2028, and so HUD's walking through that, but we have accelerated the in-person to try and get through the negotiations so we can move that forward. I will be going again in February. There's an MTW conference that occurs now every year. We, as you know, coordinated the first one in Chicago 2 years ago, and now it's in D.C., and it's being rotated around, and San Diego's doing the coordination now this year, but some staff will be going, and I'll be staying a day later to sit in the room all day with HUD to discuss the extension. That will occur again in March. in March, and hopefully be done. If not, we will have April, but we're hoping to get everything in place by April.
Hopefully not November.
I'll also be presenting at the conference on some development activities. Last year we did education. The next thing I want to let the board know is on Wednesday I'll be going down to Long Beach just for the day on a quick trip. I've been invited by the city to go discuss summer youth employment in general in front of the California Workforce Association at their annual conference. So I'm always willing and able to go push that agenda throughout the state of California to lower crime, improve opportunity, and bring real change to neighborhoods. And I think your support of the summer youth employment program is historic in the state of California, and I think we, if you look at the stats of just the crime in our neighborhoods, and how this chance of work and opportunity impacts just the pettiness of some of the crimes that go on during the summer, the vandalism and things when kids get into trouble. When they're working, they don't get into trouble, and the exposure is priceless. So I'm grateful for that. The Yardie Go Live, as you heard, the Yardie go-live is coming up. The system's going to go down on the 28th of January. It'll come up on February 8th. So we will go down and go dark and come up as Yardi. We will be closed to the public the week of the 9th, so you know, so we can verify data, make sure everything works, and everybody's got stuff to do around that. So it's going to be a busy week, although we won't be open to the public. The MTW plan will go out shortly, I think probably Friday or Monday. Dominica?
Yeah,
Friday. There will be very few changes in the MTW plan. In fact, I would say no new initiatives and only minor changes. This year, we're going to have, there's no new activities proposed. We're focusing this year on just really approving our efficiencies and our staff of the authority, the MTW authorities we already have. And we're going to start our rent initiatives because we'll have Yardi. But it is not the time to go to HUD for new authorities in the middle of the negotiations. So we've chosen to keep our plan pretty much identical to where we were last year. But it's still an exciting plan. I proofed it this afternoon. And that concludes my comments. I'm available for any questions.
Cool. Questions?
No?
All right. Well, thank you. And now we will move on to reports of commission committee. So do we have any reports from the education, medical marijuana, or travel policy committees?
No, we don't have anything from education. Oh, yeah.
No, not for 2 months.
Not for 2 months, right.
Okay. Medical marijuana did not meet. And I think the travel committee reported last month.
Yeah. We need to schedule another meeting.
Yes. Okay, good. So, okay. So we have no reports from committees for this month. Do we have any announcements by commissioners? I thought you might. Okay, Commissioner Hurd.
And I'm not. Okay, just bear with me. I was invited as commissioner for the mayor's commission on persons with disabilities with the city of Oakland to the council on mental ill offenders, and the name of that is COMEO. And that was up in Sacramento last Thursday, and we were meeting with Jeffrey Beard, is the secretary of the California Department of Corrections Rehabilitation. Oh my God, for me, that was huge. What COMEO does, COMEO investigates and promotes cost-effective approaches to meeting the long-term needs of adults and juveniles with mental disorders who are likely to become offenders or who have a history of offending. For me, it was very humbling being in the room with the Secretary of CDC in their headquarters. It was very humbling for me to be sitting at the table with the heads of the CDC departments, hearing them talk about their plan of implementation for Prop 47, hearing them talk about them wanting to partner with communities. One of the speakers, her name was Christina Howard, who is the executive director of the Board of State and Community Corrections in California, talked about Oakland, talked about the money Oakland is getting, and talked about wanting to do partnerships. She was really interested in housing. So as we move into our special needs committee and looking at how can we play a role in that area? I have a report here that I'm going to be presenting to the City of Oakland Mayor's Commission. But for me, the mindsets are changing up at the state level in the CDC, and people are looking at incarceration in a new way and wanting to see what they can do to help people with mental illness, how they can partner with our communities, our counties, and our cities. And they talked about some funding that's available. So I will be sharing this with the director and also talking about this as we meet in our first meeting. I'm not sure when that will be. But I'm really thrilled to have met the secretary of the CDC. That was big for me. And just hearing his passion for offenders and people with mental illness and wanting to do something about that. more other thing. I wanted to, I was not able to attend the rap meeting. I am so sorry, Lenita. I missed the rap meeting. I know you guys were planning, strategizing for the goals, and I missed that part. I really missed that part. So again, I'm sorry. And I want to thank you guys for holiday splendor. I was able to attend that, really enjoyed it, and was really thrilled to see the residents, you know, just being the residents, enjoying the holiday splendor, even though we changed it, we still had a good attendance. So Anita, Janet, you know, all of you, thank you for allowing us to do that. But I miss being at the rap meeting, so hopefully we can get an update on that. And I don't see any of our residents tonight. Where are they? So, you know, I just want to let you know that. So I miss being at the rap meeting. Okay. That's the end of my report.
Okay. Okay. Our new commissioner.
I have an announcement. I just wanted to piggyback on Susan Shelton because I figure that's a great volunteer opportunity. The homeless count, they're still looking for people who want to volunteer, just in case somebody did it couple of years ago, whenever they counted before. And to go out in the evening and count some of the homeless people that are, it was very, very, very rewarding. So, you know, if you want to volunteer, and it is this week and they're still looking for people, I think you can go on Alameda County's Everyone Home website and get the information and volunteer. And there's also a senior survey from the City of Oakland. They're finally doing a survey. And we need to, it really helps housing in a lot of ways when we do these surveys and we kind of find out the needs of housing and services and all the other things that, not just bricks and mortars, but all the things that seniors need to survive in Project Base and in housing authority properties, et cetera. So the senior survey is online also through the City of Oakland at the Aging and Adult Division website. But maybe I'll send it to Director and he can send it out. So thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Do we have any more announcements? Then we are ready for adjourn close session. All right. Awesome. We'll do a 5-minute break.